ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country. Sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live Summer. I'm David Marr, coming to you from Sydney on Gadigal land. The lure of Mars, the red planet, goes back to ancient times. But Americans are particularly obsessed. Elon Musk is hell-bent on building a city on Mars, despite half a dozen of his mighty rockets exploding on takeoff. Later, the strange appeal of Mars in America. But first, across the world in the last decade, in New Zealand, India, Ecuador, Canada, and Britain, rivers have been officially recognised as living beings. It's an extraordinary development inspired by the activists of the Rights of Nature movement. In his new book, Is a River Alive?, the renowned nature writer Robert McFarlane tracks the progress of that movement and takes us to some of the most pristine and one or two of the filthiest rivers in the world. Dr. McFarlane is a professor of literature and the environmental humanities at Cambridge University, and he joins me now. Welcome to Late Night Live.
Thanks, David.
Robert, what led you to ask that question, is a river alive?
Well, in my country, England, our rivers are dying. And I think we find it much easier to speak of dying rivers than we do to think of rivers as alive. But I came to realise that it shouldn't be that hard, and that extraordinary things followed imaginatively and socially and legally when one did recognise rivers as having lives and having deaths and even having rights. And yeah, I live just a mile from a little chalk stream that flows through my landscape here in Cambridge, through my days and my years, and it's a friend, it's a neighbour, it's a co-citizen. I go and talk with it, or at least think with it, when I'm joyful or grieving, and that makes perfect sense to me. And so I became fascinated by how hard we find it within, shall we say, societies raised within rationalism, a heavy utilitarianism, to speak of rivers as having lives and deaths and rights.
When you were a kid, did you have a creek or a little stream that you played in?
I did. Yeah, I did. I have not thought of this creek, this beck. We called it the beck. It's a Norse word for a little stream in Nottingham, centre of England, when I grew up. Yeah, Middle Beck, our house was called, actually named after the stream. And my brother and I would paddle there and chase the minnows. What about you? Did you?
Yes, I did. Yes, in the bush in the back of our house, there was a creek and we caught tadpoles and stomped up and down the creek and had battles in the creek. Did you have battles and wars?
I did.
It's a memory that never leaves me, that first creek.
And was it, to you, did it feel, was life there? Life was there with the water.
Life was there with the water, also adventure and imagination. It was a place where you could imagine things. It was quite filthy, actually, and it was dangerous in heavy rain. Our parents were always worried about being down the creek if it really rained. But I can't imagine kids growing up without a creek in their backyard.
Right.
So your love of these things started really young.
It did. And then, I grew up as a mountaineer is probably a rather too grandiose a way of putting it, but I mean, I've spent my life climbing mountains by one means or another, of one height or another. And of course, mountains live in this ancient dialectic with rivers. Rivers sharpen mountains into being, and mountains give rivers the gravity they need to flow and to carry out that sharpening. In the end, river is mightier and more patient than mountain. And so I spent a lot of my tens and teens, as it were, in my early 20s, climbing mountains and being around either ice rivers in the form of glaciers or water rivers. And often we would swim in them on the way down from the summits in Scotland. So I think rivers flow through people as surely as they flow through places. And I have yet to ask someone the question, who are your rivers? As I just did to you, as you just did to me, and not be given an utterly fascinating answer. We make memories with water. We remember with water. They are lifelines and life forces, rivers. But again, in my country, they have been fully instrumentalized, privatized in its entirety. The water industry here was privatized in 1989. It's still privatized. And that asset sweating, that treatment of river as liquid asset, has left us in this grievous situation of a desperately wounded and dying river system.
In the book, you visit four river systems, which I would love you to take us to now. The first of them in Ecuador. How did you hear about this river system? What took you there? What did you find?
Yeah, well, you mentioned the rights of nature movement, as it's sometimes called, the recognition of rivers as living beings in certain versions of this, as having legal standing, that is to say, the capacity to be represented and to represent themselves in court, and rights, the recognition that a river might have an inalienable, permanent right. For example, the right to flow. Now, in Ecuador, this, as it were, legal dream, this form of magical thinking, took on extraordinary legislative force in 2008 when the Ecuadorian constitution was revised following the election of Rafael Correa in 2007. And this turmoil of reimagining a country's fundamental governing principles happened between late 07 and the autumn of 08. And in that time, four articles were placed right at the heart of that new constitution. And the first of them guarantees and recognizes the rights of nature, rivers, forests, to exist, to flourish, and to persist. And the last of them makes the state the guarantor of those rights and allows any citizen, really, in Ecuador to bring a case on behalf of nature if nature's rights are being seen to be violated. So it's an extraordinary legislative act of what I call moral imagination taking legal form. And those articles went at some level kind of underused for more or less the first decade of their life after their creation and installation in the constitution. And then in 2021, a long-running lawsuit reached its finale in the Constitutional Court in Ecuador. And that concerned the right to life of a cloud forest called Los Cedros, the cedar forest in northwest Ecuador. And that cloud forest and its many rivers, because a cloud forest is a river maker, were threatened with absolute destruction by gold mining. And this judgment was handed down in the winter of 2021. It's a beautiful document, jurisprudential philosophy at its most elegant and compelling, which recognized the rights of the rivers to flow and the forest to grow, caused the mining companies to be evicted from the region. That ruling still stands. It's precarious because gold prices, as we know, have reached an all-time high now. And as gold prices rise, so the pressure on those remarkable, irreplaceable forests grows.
And you went to the forest and you found three rivers, not one, but three.
Yes. So I was lucky to go with the judges, actually, two of the three judges who wrote and handed down that remarkable judgment in the winter of 2021. But they had not ever met the forest and its rivers because the court case came to its climax during COVID. So they remotely, as it were, recognized and heard what one of them calls the voice of the forest. But I was able to be with them, and we traveled up to this remote region of Cloud Forest. I was joined by a lawyer of the rights of nature and human rights, a Colombian lawyer, Cesar, a field recordist called Cosmo, and an extraordinary mycologist, fungi specialist called Juliana Ferchi, who's a Chilean. And yeah, we traveled up there, and we met the rivers of that place of utmost life, teeming abundance, diversity, and endemicity. The Sky River, the river of vapor, the Rio Los Cedros, the river of the cedars itself, which we followed up as close as we could get to its source in the high Cloud Forest.
The river at your feet.
The river at our feet, that one was. And then the river below our feet, which was the groundwater that moves through that landscape. And that is carried in part by fungal networks.
And you write about a waterfall, the two streams of the waterfall. Describe, and is it still that way today?
It is still that way today, yes. Nature shimmers into symbol in a place like that while remaining profoundly itself. But this was one of the most emblematic things I ever saw in 4 years of river journey. And it was twin waterfalls coming down a cliff face in a clearing, and one drained one watershed and one drained another. And one of those watersheds had early prospecting drilling carried out by the mining company, and the other was pristine. And the water that flowed from the pristine watershed was bright and lucid and silver, and the one that flowed from the drilled watershed was red with silt and with the beginnings of the toxicity that would absolutely engulf that watershed were the mining to go ahead. And they both crashed down into the pool at the base and mingled their colours. They licked tongues there. And all of it was there, the hope, the despair, the futility, the power of global capital. And I wanted to find ways of writing about that, about how that tiny, extraordinary place was deeply implicated in these vast global structures of which we are all a part. The gold that is mined at some level from places like that ends up in our laptops, is making it possible for us to talk to one another today. So these are highly complex questions, but the saving of the forest represented a profoundly moral moment in legal history, and an ecocentric one rather than an anthropocentric one.
I'm talking to Robert McFarlane about his new book, Is a River Alive?, on Late Night Live. Robert, has that ruling, the constitutional change in Ecuador, inspired other countries? Has it been a source of law in other countries?
Yes, yes. So amazing things are happening in this space, as lawyers call it. I think the other well-known sort of global landmark in this reimagining of law and of water and of rights is the 2017 Te Awatupua Act, which took place in Aotearoa, New Zealand, and which recognised the Whanganui River not only as having legal standing, the capacity to represent itself and be represented in court, but also that it was a living and spiritual entity, continuous with the iwi, the Maori tribe of the Whanganui, continuous with their life ways. I am the river and the river is me is the famous lyric, which actually sits within that legislative document. And there you start to see ways in which this reimagining of rivers is starting to irrigate legal language and legal structures as well. It's an extraordinary document and was the outcome, as so often, of extraordinary campaigning led, in this case, by the Whanganui iwi. And then those two gong strikes, if you like, Ecuador in 2008, Te Awatupua and Aotearoa, New Zealand, 2017, have inspired many countries, campaigns, activists, river guardians to seek themselves to reimagine how water lives with us and how we live with water. And Australia is really busy in this regard. Anne Polina, the Nyakinawara scholar activist, who is just one of my one of my intellectual heroes, who works on the Matawarra Fitzroy River. She has a wonderful way of describing this. She says, the law is being used creatively to train human beings to listen, pay attention to, and learn from rivers.
That's not something the law has done in the past. That's a fresh role for the law. The lawyer in me, Robert, wants to know who represents a river. If a river is a living being and has personhood and rights, who goes to court and says, I am the river?
I'm the river and the river is me. Well, so here we get into the weeds of as it were, the devolved governance that this leads to. It's a very good and a very hard question. And the best answer that has been produced is that bodies of river guardians who live close by continuously with the river are appointed. And this is what happened within the Te Awa Tupua Act. There was the formal recognition of a guardianship group, and that they become the best fit voice of and for the river, while recognizing that this will always be a best rather than a perfect fit. And in Canada, one of the three big riverscapes, as it were, journeys that I made of field work and research for this book, there, the Innu community at Iquanish, this tiny township of the Innu, who have lived with and around the rivers of that region for the best part of 8,000 years, were also appointed and formalized themselves into a kind of guardianship group in alliance with the regional council in that area. Again, an extraordinary document, a so-called mirror resolution, issued again in late 2021, recognizing the Mutesha Kaushipu, this extraordinary river I paddled down over two turbulent weeks, as a living being and a rights-bearing being.
In The New Scientist, Rowan Hooper took issue with you, saying that while he understood that ecosystems could be given or recognised to have legal rights, but to go further, he said, was to go too far when you called the river a life form. Do you think this sort of the personification of a river might be a good metaphor, but not really very effective law?
Oh, no. Well, he said that at that point he parts company on the grounds that it becomes anti-scientific. And I suppose I push gently back against this idea that it's anti-scientific, because what that presupposes is a certain account of what science is and what knowledge is. And the communities that I worked with, travelled with in Chennai, in Ecuador, in Itasinan, and in fact in England in different ways and in different contexts, to them, their knowledge forms are absolutely rigorous and internally consistent and metaphysically and philosophically profound, but they wouldn't be recognized as scientific, and their recognition of the river as alive would be, as it were, dismissed as anti-scientific by Rowan Hooper. But to me, this I think at some level smacks of a partisan understanding of how knowledge structures work. And I would not wish to tell Rita Mestakosho, the Innu poet and activist who led the defense of the Mutesha Kaushipu, that her recognition, her knowledge of that river as alive was inadmissible, was anti-scientific.
Yes. Let's go to a rather unhappier stretch of the world, and to the rivers of Chennai.
Yeah. So we're in southeast India now. Tamil Nadu is the state. And Chennai, Madras, as it was under British colonial rule, when I will say a lot of the water problems there were originated, at least, is a city of three rivers and many, many marshes. So you have the Kosastalaya, then the Kuam, and then the Adya River. So it really is a water city, and indeed the British sort of romanticised it as a Venice, an Indian Venice. And now those rivers for much of the year are for much of their length as they move through that city, pretty much biologically dead. There are places where there is zero species count and 0% dissolved oxygen. And this is a function of sewage and chemical pollution, so vast in its volume and intense in its concentration that it has all but obliterated life from these rivers. They change their form and then they become truly monstrous and catastrophically so when the cyclones come. And so Chennai lives locked into this kind of drought flood cycle, which is at some level a function of shifting climate and at another level a function of a structural water illiteracy that has taken city form, as it were, over decades. And so I worked with an extraordinary young group there, led by a young man called Yuvan Aves, who are trying to reintroduce a water literacy, a river literacy, to think with water and envision a just and inclusive future for rivers and all the life that flourishes from them in that city. But wow, they have their work cut out.
Your description of the river, sort of full of feces and muck, could well be the Thames in the 19th century. You just have to dig sewers, don't you?
Digging sewers, as you all know, is a long-term and complex problem, especially in a city as densely populated as Chennai. But yes, absolutely, there is hard infrastructural work to be done, but the political will to do that is largely absent. And so the work of this group I call the Angels, the chapter is called Ghosts, Monsters and Angels, is really beginning to try and tell new stories about rivers. In fact, that is what writers like me do. It's what many of the people I met do, is to try to change the story around rivers from sump and dump and drain back to a recognition of their role as memory keepers, storytellers and life forces.
Is your task to make us fall in love with rivers, individual rivers?
Well, I would love that to happen. And as I move around this country and subsequently North America, speaking of these subjects, these ideas, these people, these rivers, these places, again and again, I recognize how close to the surface a love of rivers is in many people. Very instinctive. I think we have had a love language, as it were, for rivers, largely drummed out of us, almost illegalized as somehow hippie or woo-woo, as anti-scientific, if you like. But actually, I think for many people, it comes very naturally. And in my country, we have seen, as the visibility of and severity of the rivers crisis in England, where we have not a single river in good overall health, has become more widely known, so commensurately this extraordinary guardianship movement has sprung up, taking the slack that government has left and that regulators have left and that monitoring has left. And it has its source in something like love.
And it's even made authorities fall in love enough with a little river in East Sussex to give it rights and legal personhood. Now, I can understand in South America, Robert, you know, in India, in, you know, even in French Canada, but in England, this is really remarkable. East Sussex.
Why England? Because we're the bastion of anthropocentric rigor.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah, well.
How did this happen?
You could have knocked me over with a feather as well. Yeah, so this is the Ouse. We have actually many oozes. It's a wonderful name for a river. This is a surprisingly unmuddy ooze, actually, in Sussex. And it forms a gorgeous looping set of meanders as it approaches the sea, the English Channel. And yes, the Lewes District Council, in a pretty much cross-party and highly commended motion, has agreed to champion a charter of rights for the River Ouse. How did this happen? Well, it is interesting that it gained cross-party support. In fact, it was proposed by a Conservative council member and has really, as it were, sailed through. But it has done so on the back of a lot of hard community work by the Environmental Law Foundation here and by an organization called Love Our Ooze, who are trying to tell a different story, organize communities to recognize and speak of and listen to their rivers in their river in a different way. And that is, and now starting to, as it were, grow upwards into structures of governance. And that's exciting. It's a tiny, tiny foothold in a country and a jurisdiction that has absolutely set its face against the recognition of rights. But yeah, there in Australia, things are shifting as well. I mean,
is there evidence of such a thing? We just pump money out of rivers. That's what rivers are for in this country.
Well, that's what they're for in my country too. Tell me how the pumping happens. You mean just as ecosystem service provider?
No, it's a complex story of water rights for irrigators, which a Conservative government about 25 years ago decided to separate the rights from the land so the rights could be traded for immense sums of money. But this is why you have an obligation to come out to Australia, and we will walk you up and down the Murrumbidgee and the Darling, and please write about them. make the authorities in this country fall in love with them. But look, that's for down the track. Robert, thank you so much for joining us on the show. I've been talking to Robert McFarlane, Professor of Literature and the Environmental Humanities at Cambridge, about his book, Is a River Alive?, which is published by Penguin Random House. And people should also go and have a look at the documentary that Robert wrote called River, a 2021 documentary, which is enormously praised. It's really, in a way, an Australian documentary directed by Jennifer Peedham and narrated by William Dafoe. And I think it's on Netflix and Apple and Prime. It's easy to find. Robert, thank you so much for joining us on the show to talk rivers. One last quick question. Which is the most beautiful river in the world?
That's an unfair question.
It's not.
Who's your favourite child?
Oh, Little Bill, of course. He's the best human I've ever met, and he's only three. But,
Well, I'll give you one fresh from my memory, and that is the Mutesikashipu or Magpie River, which flows south to meet the Gulf of St. Lawrence near Anticosti Island, and it rivered me deeply.
And it's beautifully described in Is a River Alive? Robert, thanks.
Thanks, David.
Coming up, our strange fascination with Mars. Romans named it after the god of war, whose colours were blood, and the fascination with Mars has never died. The planet is there in myth, in astronomy, in fiction, and even in trade. My cousins in the crane business call themselves up in the sky the men from Mars. It's something I've lived with humbly for years. In America right now, the obsession with Mars is particularly strong, with Elon Musk promising to put 1 million Earthlings up there in the next 20 years, a project he's offering to fast-track with his own sperm. My guest today, David Barron, explores the origins of this obsession in his book, The Martians, The True Story of an Alien Craze That Captured Turn-of-the-Century America. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you, David.
You write that Mars possesses an undeniable aura of mystery and romance, an allure not fully explained by its physical reality. Why does it? Why has it always captured our imagination? Is it simply because it's red?
Well, in ancient times, that was part of it. It does have a strange red or sometimes orange or salmon color. Because it comes around close to Earth every 2 years and 2 months, it flares to prominence briefly during that period, and then it fades away into the background stars. So it was known from ancient times to be quite odd. But I really think the main reason it captures our attention today is because of the period I write about from about 120 years ago, because it was at the turn of the last century, the 1890s and the beginning of the 20th century, when Mars just captured the world's imagination. I mean, the title of my book, the subtitle says, An Alien Craze That Captured the Turn of the Century America, but it really captured the world.
And we live in the shadow of that huge uprising of popular enthusiasm for the planet. Still, 120-something years later, it's kind of still here.
Oh, absolutely. The ripples have continued down to today. So this, for me, it really began because I was born in the 1960s. And as a child, there seemed to be Martians everywhere in popular culture and cartoons on TV. In the United States, there was a popular sitcom called My Favorite Martian in the 1960s. There was, of course, science fiction about Martians. There were Martians in movies. And I grew up and became a science writer. I write about astronomy. And I started to wonder, where did that all come from? And when I looked at newspapers from the very beginning of the 20th century, I just was floored by what I discovered, because before Martians were staples of science fiction, they were truly believed to be scientific fact. You could open the New York Times and other serious newspapers from that era and read about the Martian civilization.
And we will open those newspapers. But one thing, David, that really fascinates me about these depictions of Martians is that these Martians are always intelligent. They're not primitive.
Well, that was part of the theory. So Mars, let me back up a minute. I mean, the main proponent of this idea that Mars was inhabited by a civilization was an American astronomer named Percival Lowell. And he had quite an elaborate theory, but it fit with other ideas of Mars at the time. And one of the widely held views about Mars was that it was an older planet than Earth. It formed before Earth did. If life emerged on Mars, it probably emerged there before Earth. And therefore, if you imagine that life moves in lockstep toward civilization, well, then Mars probably had civilization before we did. So the Martians were thought to be ahead of us in evolution. They were smarter. They were more technologically savvy. And also, for other reasons, they were also thought to be better than us in terms of their moral standards. They were more peaceful than us. People thought the Martians were...
Ooh, they could also be dangerous. You know, they came to Earth commenced a war. But look, let's roll back a bit, because
sure.
From your book, it seems to me that the principal evidence for this notion that Mars was an earlier civilization was the observation in the 1870s by an Italian astronomer who saw what he thought were channels on the surface of the planet. Now, tell us about that.
Sure. So his name was Giovanni Schiaparelli. He was quite a renowned astronomer. He headed the observatory in Milan. And in 1877, when Mars made a particularly close approach to Earth, he decided he was going to study it night after night to make a detailed map. And what Schiaparelli saw was a landscape that seemed sort of Earth-like. It had dark areas and light areas that he thought were oceans and continents. But there were also these very fine lines that were exceptionally straight. And he imagined they were waterways of some sort, channels. In Italian, the word is canali. Well, when that was translated to English, it was mistranslated to canals. And people started to talk about canals on Mars, which at first was sort of a joke. People knew that that was a mistranslation. But Percival Lowell, the American astronomer who came along in 1894 with his own theory, said they are canals, not canals for navigation, but canals for irrigation. And he believed that the Martian civilization had built a global irrigation network to bring the only water that was left on the planet, and that was in the polar ice caps, down to their farms and their cities. And this is what the Martians had to do to survive on a planet that was running out of water.
So the canals, so-called, in inverted commas, they are really the only evidence, is this right? The only evidence of this civilization that had once flourished on another planet.
Well, it certainly was the main evidence. But it wasn't just that their lines were there. They also seemed to come and go with the seasons mysteriously. So what could that be? Well, if they were like mountain chains or something, that wouldn't occur. You'd always see them. So what are these strange lines? Lowell said, well, then you're not seeing the water in the canals. The canals would have to be many miles wide to see that. What you're seeing is the vegetation growing on the banks of the canals. And so for that reason, you're seeing them, the vegetation green up in the spring and the summer, and hence the lines appear. And in the fall and winter, as the vegetation dies off for the year, they fade away. And so it, in that way it fit. But there were once the idea was out there, I mean, some people believe that the Martians were sending signals to Earth. And so that also, whether they were strange lights on Mars, or the inventor Nikola Tesla, who in 1899 thought he'd picked up radio signals from Mars, that all added to this mania.
Driving this mania was the figure of Lowell. Tell us about Lowell. He was an ornament of the Boston rich. Was he an amateur, or was he actually a scientist?
Well, today we would call him an amateur. But at that time, you know, astronomy was just starting to professionalize, and quite a few astronomers did not have a strong academic background in the field. And there were actually a lot of gentlemen astronomers who were really lawyers or doctors or businessmen who had the money to buy their own large telescopes, and they added to discoveries of what's in space. So Lowell was not a professional, but being an amateur was not necessarily seen as something terrible or
oh, no, not at all.
Right. But he was extraordinarily wealthy. The Lowells of Massachusetts made their fortune in textiles at the very beginning of the American Industrial Revolution. All the Lowell men pretty much went to Harvard University. So Lowell graduated in 1876. And he, for a while, he was a well-known author. He traveled the world. He spent a lot of time in Asia. But he came to astronomy quite late. It wasn't until he was getting close to the age of 40 that he fixated on Mars, that this was going to be how he would make his name, which, you know, being a Lowell, you kind of had to prove yourself worthy. And he was going to do that through his study of Mars.
So the idea is there. There is already an enthusiasm for Mars. There are these extraordinary theories about, you know, dying civilizations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then along comes H.G. Wells.
Right. So you said earlier that the Martians were not necessarily friendly and peaceful. And of course, H.G. Wells famously, so he was at that time in the 1890s, he was a quickly rising star in literature. He had written The Time Machine, and he was making a name for himself, and then he writes The War of the Worlds, which was based on what astronomers were seeing. They were seeing evidence of life on Mars, and so he used his own imagination, again, with this idea that the Martians were ahead of us in evolution. In fact, his Martians, which were these disgusting, hideous creatures that were basically, they looked sort of like a jellyfish or an octopus. They had just one gelatinous head with tentacles coming off.
And haven't artists loved them ever since?
Yeah, right. You know, but of course they got around in these tripods, these machines that they rampaged across London when they came to Earth. But H.G. Wells was imagining what humans might become in the future as we rely more on technology. We basically were just going to become brains with tentacles that we can use our machines. But that was H.G. Wells's idea, that the Martians potentially had their eyes on Earth to come invade us. Remarkably, I mean, when I started writing my book, I thought, well, probably that's what a lot of people thought. That was hardly ever discussed, the danger from the Martians. By far, I mean, 99% of the references to Martians was that they were creatures we would want to come to know and, in fact, emulate, rather than monsters we should fear.
And Lowell kept going, kept lecturing, writing poetry about Mars, to the extent that the New York Times in 1906 had a banner headline, "There is life on the planet Mars. Professor Percival Lowell, recognized as the greatest authority on the subject, declares there can be no doubt that living beings inhabit our neighbor world." This is just extraordinary. This is all bunkum.
Right. Well, and that's one of the reasons I just loved writing this story, because it has so many strange elements to it. It all started out sort of whimsical. I mean, a few years before that, you had Martians showing up, in Broadway plays and vaudeville skits and in silly songs. But by 1906, 1907, the idea had really taken on a certain gravity, and people began to believe it was pretty much proven. The Wall Street Journal, of course, another very serious conservative U.S. newspaper, in 1907, at the end of the year, said the biggest news of 1907 was proof of life, of intelligent human life on Mars, they said. Alexander Graham Bell, the inventor of the telephone, who by the early 20th century was really an elder statesman of American science, he weighed in and said, there's no question that there is intelligent life on Mars. It became really that ingrained.
But it was not because fresh evidence had emerged.
Well, it was sort of that fresh evidence had emerged. But Percival Lowell was, among other things, an erudite man. He would give these lectures. He would write magazine articles in a fashion that today seems kind of stilted, but back then was seen as very intellectual and punny. He loved puns. So he was seen as very clever, and he really pushed this idea quite seriously. But also, now remember, this was, of course, the 1890s and the beginning of the 20th century. Photography was still pretty young, particularly when it came to astrophotography, taking pictures of celestial bodies like planets. So most of the depictions of the so-called canals on Mars were drawings that astronomers made. And so you had to trust that the astronomer was seeing things properly and drawing them things properly. Well, Lowell decided the way to get around that was to figure out how to take good photographs of Mars. And he had his team at his observatory, which was in and still is in Flagstaff, Arizona, develop new techniques of photography. And by 1907, he had thousands of these tiny little pictures of Mars. You couldn't make them any larger because they were so grainy, you wouldn't see anything. But these quarter-inch photographs of Mars that he claimed and the public bought showed without any doubt that the lines were there. Now, of course, even if the lines were there, that doesn't mean they're canals. But he'd been talking about it for so long that that's when the Wall Street Journal said, we have proof of life, intelligent life on Mars.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to David Barron about his book on the human obsession and delight in Mars. The planet, of course, we're talking about the planet. David, what's the scientific consensus now about those canals?
Well, so I don't want to give everything away. I don't want to be a spoiler, but let's say that the...
Now, come on.
Clearly there are no canals on Mars. There is no civilization there. This was all, you were looking at a planet that at its closest is 35 million miles away. And at that time, the only way to see it was through Earth-bound telescopes. So you're looking through the Earth's atmosphere. So the Earth's atmosphere creates distortion. The telescope creates distortion. The eye creates distortion. Eyes can very easily be tricked by optical illusions. So the question came along, are these lines really there at all? Or is it some figment of either the imagination of the mind or the way the eye perceives the planet's surface. And it was probably a combination of all those things. But eventually, the astronomical community essentially erased those lines from Mars altogether.
Has the magic of Mars been dissipated by the fact that we've been there now several times? I mean, not humans, but at least we've put machines on the surface of the planet.
The amazing thing about Mars is it just keeps it keeps compelling our interest. I mean, we keep learning new things about it. We know there's no civilization there. We know that there are no canals, but we continue to learn fascinating things. I mean, it's only in the last few decades we've learned that Mars was once very Earth-like. There's evidence that water once flowed. It once had a thick atmosphere. It likely was habitable several billion years ago. Now, was it inhabited? We don't know. But there's a great mystery You know, there are several places in the solar system that are thought to be the most likely places to have life. Mars is certainly near or at the top of that list. NASA has the Perseverance rover right now that's picking up rock samples or drilling, coring rock samples from bedrock and storing them, hopefully to be brought back to Earth eventually to see if there might be evidence of fossilized life there. We're talking about microbes, not canal-building intelligent beings, but still, that's a source of fascination. And you mentioned Elon Musk. He's not the only one who has this idea that we should start moving to Mars. There's a society called the Mars Society. It's been around for almost 30 years, made up a lot of quite serious scientists, some from NASA, who are pushing the idea that human beings should start sending some of us scouts to Mars with the idea of eventually making it a second Earth. You know, it's, I don't think we've lost our fascination. It's just changed.
This extraordinary notion that Mars might be a last refuge for the very, 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 very rich of the human race, presumably after we've exhausted this planet, after we've destroyed this planet. Is that the idea? Then we shoot off to Mars and start all over again.
Oh, I sure hope not. I mean, that is certainly the way it's been depicted in some ways, and maybe that's the way Elon Musk thinks about it. But I don't think so. He does want, he has said he wants to make it so that anyone with a middle-class lifestyle would have enough money to go buy a ticket to Mars and start living there. I mean, I think that's wildly optimistic that that would happen anytime soon. But he wants to build a new civilization down there. Now, in my book, 120 years ago, when people were talking about Mars and this magical civilization there, we were projecting onto the planet our own hopes and dreams, the idea that there could be a better world out there. Mars was the better world that we should emulate. And I think we're seeing a very similar thing today. Now, folks like Elon Musk talk about Mars being a better world that we will create. We will start over again. We will build a new civilization that doesn't have the problems we have here on Earth.
Exactly now, the same argument.
Right. And of course, we were fooling ourselves back then. And I think we're fooling ourselves now to think that we can start over and not bring our problems with us. But does that mean that I think it's a bad idea to go to Mars or to dream about finding a way to get there? I don't think so, because the dream itself is very powerful. The dream of Martians back over 100 years ago helped inspire the rise of science fiction. In fact, inspired the very scientists who went on to develop the first rockets that could get us to outer space. And I think sometimes it takes a dreamer. Elon Musk is a man who's very complex and there's a lot about him I don't like. But sometimes it takes a visionary, a dreamer, someone who's maybe a little crazy to push us to think have new ideas that really do push us to some new level. And that's what Lowell did with his crazy ideas about Mars back then. I don't know if Musk is going to do it now, but I'm all for having some aspirations to start going to Mars while protecting the Earth, not as an escape from an Earth that we're going to let die off. But eventually, we are going to need to spread out, because someday, it may not be for a billion years, but someday there will be a cataclysm that strikes Earth. And if you're thinking in the really, really, really long term, humankind will need to spread out onto another planet eventually.
It seems to me that you started out with this project to expose bunkum, to show what nonsense all of this was, but that you came in the end to really admire the imaginative leaps that are involved in the belief in Mars, in the romance and the power of this planet.
That's exactly right. I thought I was going to be writing a cautionary tale, and it is a cautionary tale. We have to be careful not to get so caught up in believing things that we want to be true that we ignore the evidence showing that, in fact, it is all bunkum. But at the same time, there's a great power in imagination. And there's a wonderful quote from Albert Einstein, and I won't get it right. But Einstein himself said that imagination is a critical aspect of science.
More important than knowledge, he said.
Imagination
is more important than knowledge, for knowledge is limited whereas imagination embraces the entire world.
Boy, I set you up really well for that. That's exactly right.
I'm fully prepared.
And I think that that's right. It's sometimes being too conservative in science is not so good. We need to leave room for imagination because that is what pushes us forward in discovery and exploration.
But David, in the end, it's the truth that matters.
I agree completely. But until we know the truth, sometimes it's imagination that pushes us to find out what the truth is.
When you were growing up with those comic books and things, I grew up with them as well. Martians with bug eyes and bald heads, and they were so present in our imaginations. But are kids growing up with that now, or is that over?
That's a very good question. I don't know. I get the sense that Martians are less common in comic books and so forth. Aliens may still be out there. But still, you know, people sometimes use Martian as a synonym for alien. People still talk about if a man from Mars came to Earth, what would he think? It's still part of our lexicon and part of our culture.
If a man from Mars came to Earth, he would build an enormous crane on the side of a building that is being constructed in any number of the world's cities, David. But that's perhaps another issue entirely. There's no other planet, is there, that has this power?
Not in our solar system, no. You know, interesting, one other reason I thought that the book had some relevance today is we now know of more than 5,000 planets outside our solar system. The James Webb Space Telescope and other new observatories and spacecraft are looking for detecting these other planets around other stars and starting to look for signs of life, to see what the atmospheres are made of, to see if that might suggest life. And I wouldn't be surprised if in the next 10, 20 years, there's talk of planets around other stars for which there's really good evidence of life. But, and we may see a similar sort of mania start up.
But for us mortals, there's a kind of, we're being overwhelmed now with planets. And so there's a sense that let's just stick with the ones we know. And the one we think we know best is Mars.
Well, and it is our close neighbor. You know, Venus is our other close neighbor, but no one wants to go to Venus. You'd be crushed and seared if you went to the surface of the planet there. Mars really is a little Earth. And one, you know, seeing pictures of it, it looks a heck of a lot like Earth. You can imagine standing there. You know, it almost looks like a landscape from an old Western, an old movie.
Oh, it looks like Utah, you mean?
It precisely. Exactly.
David.
And yeah.
Would you go there if you could?
Oh, gosh, no.
Why not?
Well, first of all, I'm 61 years old, and I'll leave it to someone younger. But, it's going to take at least 6 to 8 months to get there. You'd be stuck there for probably another 8 months before you could come home. Mars is a terrible place. It would want to kill you from the extraordinarily thin atmosphere to the toxic soils, to the dust storms that can envelop the whole planet, to the radiation that comes down onto the surface that you're not protected from. I'm not saying people can't go there. We'll figure out how to do it and hopefully do it safely.
But not
you. There are young people who are ready to go. And I'm all for it. I mean, they should go safely. But I would love to see someone standing on the surface of Mars while I'm still alive on Earth.
David, thank you for joining us on Late Night Live.
David, it was my pleasure.
I've been speaking to David Barron. David's book is The Martians, the true story of an alien craze that captured turn-of-the-century America, and it's published by Norton. And that's the show. On our next, Philippe Sands, writer and human rights lawyer, takes us back to the shocking story of the Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet's long flight from justice, first in England and then back in Chile, a story of crime, conscience, and impunity. Thank you.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.